Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I think you know who I am from the back projection. It's a great pleasure for me to be able to introduce this third lecture in our series of rather important lectures by past British Foreign Secretaries. Before I introduce Lord Howe, let me remind you that there are two more this term, at least. Lord Hurd, Tuesday the 11th of November, Sir Malcolm Rifkin, Tuesday the 18th of November, both in this theatre at the same time. I hope to see you then. We hope that we will have Robin Cook after Christmas, but this is still being negotiated, so no promises. Well, now to this evening's business. I'm very glad indeed to be able to welcome Lord Howe to the LSE, not least, if I may say so, because he was kind enough to launch a book of mine many years ago, and I always think of him, of course, as anyone who's lived through the 1980s British politics thinks of him as Sir Geoffrey Howe, so if I occasionally slip in the title, he'll forgive me. He is, in fact, one of the most significant figures in British post-war political history. He served in the Heath government as Solicitor General and then Minister for Trade and Consumer Affairs. But perhaps most significant of all, he served for almost the whole time of the Thatcher government, 1979 to 1990, leaving in rather dramatic circumstances not long before Mrs. Thatcher herself left, two events not being wholly unconnected. He was, of course, Chancellor of the Exchequer, 1979 to 1983, Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, 1983 to 1989, a crucial period, you will remember, a period that my colleague Fred Halliday called the Second Cold War, and indeed the end of the Cold War, coming up to those dramatic events of 1989 and German unification, and finally, in that last year, 1989 to 90, as Deputy Prime Minister. He's been in the House of Lords since 1992, where he continues to make significant contributions. He also has, of course, experience by virtue of those two major offices of state, Chancellor of the Exchequer and Foreign Secretary, not a common experience to hold both of those. Enormous experience of bringing together classical foreign policy in the high politics sense, security politics and foreign economic policy. And in the latter capacity, he is someone who's attended 11 World Economic Summits. I don't know how many people can beat that record. I would also like to say that he's married to Lady Howe, Elspeth Howe, who's in the front row, and welcome to Lady Howe as well, who is an alumna of the school and indeed a governor. It's very nice to see you here tonight. So, Lord Howe is going to talk about problems left over by history, of which, as we know, there are a great many, and it'll be fascinating to hear his analysis. Thank you so much.
Let me begin by thanking you. Can you all hear me properly? For the honour of being invited to give one of these lectures, and in a small way to repay the debt of gratitude that I feel and that our family feels to the London School of Economics for the courteous and kind way in which you've treated my wife. Because it's revealing no secrets to say that she came here at a relatively advanced age. She ceased to have a job in the marketplace when I became Chancellor of the Exchequer and got tired with merely being a minister's wife. So I think while I was Chancellor, she set about studying, getting a degree in social administration here at the LSE. And the way in which she was received and treated by fellow students as well as by the staff was a method of enormous kindness. While she was jetting around the world with me as Foreign Secretary, she was busy studying notes taken by other students. The only embarrassing thing that ever happened was that at the start of her course, she couldn't get hold of one of the textbooks that she very badly needed. So she asked me if I could perhaps borrow one from the House of Commons library. And there was an outburst of astonishment some weeks later when the press reported that the Chancellor of the Exchequer had applied to the Commons Library for a textbook of principles of elementary economics. Anyway, be that as it may, I have to say that it was a relief when I thought of the title for this talk some months ago, because it sounded like a title that was quite thought-provoking, but it actually postponed the process of deciding what I was going to talk about. And that was a rather disastrous thing to do, because it took me much longer to decide. I hope I've avoided disaster at the end of the day. But in fact, the title itself gives a very misleading impression of a foreign secretary's agenda. First, because problems is probably the wrong word. The word problems implies the existence of a solution. And the second, problems left over by history, again, suggests an ordered array of problems waiting to be picked up and dealt with consecutively. Real life, of course, is much less orderly than that. Only a minority of diplomatic problems actually achieve or hope to achieve a solution. Many of them have to be managed, some almost indefinitely, in the context of some other quite different, broader relationship. Often one can do little more than set the problem on course to what one day may be a solution. And some problems, of course, burst from a clear blue sky on a wholly innocent foreign secretary, like the fatwa which emerged on St. Valentine's Day 1989. And I heard about it at dawn, so to speak. And by lunchtime, I had to have completed reading the satanic verses so that I could talk about it on The World at One. It's that kind of thing which takes you by surprise. One very striking feature about all these things is the extent to which what happens depends crucially upon the composition of the group of officials, ministers, diplomats, other professionals who have to decide on your reaction. Sometimes the input of a particular diplomat or professional can be absolutely critical. More often, it's the experience, the temperament, the mood of the politicians that is more decisive. Now, in light of that analysis, I think I was quite fortunate, at least in some respects, in the timing of my own arrival at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Because by that time, June 1983, I'd been working in partnership with the Prime Minister for 8 full years, covering my time as Shadow Chancellor and Chancellor. We were almost halfway through our time together, halfway towards the conclusion of our quasi-matrimonial relationship. And for 4 years, by the time I joined her at the Foreign Office, the Prime Minister had been engaged at top-level foreign policy decision-making as Prime Minister. And she had demonstrated, and this is very important, star quality of a quite remarkable kind. I'm sure some of you in the audience may have been with us when we went to the Tokyo Economic Summit in summer 1979. And in those days, the heads of government, all of them, had to give separate statements to the press conference. It was a feast of competitive rhetoric. And in Tokyo, because of the astonishment of Japanese womanhood at the existence of a woman prime minister, the hall had been packed with wives and hangers-on of diplomats and journalists and all the rest of them, gazing open-eyed at this phenomenon. Margaret Thatcher, because she was the new kid on the block, made the last of these prepared statements. She had to be followed by the hapless Roy Jenkins, there as president of the European Commission. And she was the only one who spoke not from a script. She spoke extempore, although she thought very carefully about it. And it was an absolute wow. And one realized then that we had got a totally new phenomenon in this leader. And I think that it's very important to recognize that. Moreover, she had been guided, by the time I joined her, through her first 4 years, by the Foreign Secretary of enormous experience, whom we've had the privilege of hearing last week, Peter Carrington. And by that same date, as your chairman was kind enough to point out, even I had ceased to be a complete novice in the wider world, because I had done Minister of Trade in the Heath government, and as Foreign Secretary, and as Chancellor of the Exchequer, rather, and Shadow Chancellor, I'd attended a number of summits, I'd attended a number of ECOFIN meetings in Europe, I'd presided over 2 or 3 realignments of the European monetary system, I'd become chairman of the interim committee. So all of that had given me some feel for international affairs. So by the time the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary got into joint harness together in 1983, we were both reasonably mature creatures, both quite worldly wise, and still in those early post-Treasury days when we were quite harmonious, we were a well-adjusted partnership. 7 years still to go before the breakup of our relationship. And much that we did achieve, or worked at anyway, was governed by the balance of that relationship. I realized only a day or two ago that probably a better title for this talk would have been borrowed from Nigel Nicholson if I decided to call it Portrait of a Marriage. Now, we started off, inevitably, focused upon the Cold War, as you said in the introduction. History could scarcely have bequeathed a greater problem, not least because at that time, Margaret Thatcher was cast as the Iron Lady, shoulder to shoulder with Ronald Reagan, in confronting the evil empire. And people expected a generation of further confrontation. Happily, we had a brief interval before this problem came to a head. At that time, George Shultz, the American Secretary of State, had been in office for about 12 months. And in June of 1983, sing the right kind of mood music. And George Shultz told Congress, I quote, "Our fundamental and common interest in the avoidance of war impels us to work towards a relationship that can lead to a safer world for all mankind." And it was a mature judgment of enormous importance, which I shared. It was exactly to that end that in the first week of July, I convened a meeting of officials, ministers, trying to see where exactly we went along that road. We all felt that the United States might finally be moving away from a mode in which she had no apparent interest in the Soviet Union, except to defame her. And in those circumstances, some of us dared to think, Britain could hardly be better placed to take advantage of any opportunities that might open up. It should be possible for Britain to play a significant part, perhaps in weakening the Soviet grip on Eastern Europe, even perhaps encouraging some positive changes in the Soviet Union itself. So we concluded our seminar of Foreign Office and other officials with a menu for action of some 20 points. We didn't know how that would play at number 10, but very remarkably, almost at the same time, we got the message that the Prime Minister would herself welcome a broader two-day seminar at Chequers, attended by academics with expertise in the Soviet Union, as well as the rest of us, to study that topic in particular and other foreign policy topics. So we arranged a meeting at Chequers for the 8th and 9th of September that year. The timing was actually extremely well chosen, because just 1 week before we met, the Korean airliner 007, with 269 passengers on board, was shot down without warning in the Sea of Japan by Soviet fighter aircraft. And equally by chance, 4 days after that, I was to have my first meeting at a CSCE meeting in Madrid with that great figure, Andrei Gromyko, the Soviet foreign minister. I have to say the meeting fell well short of being a success. It was brusque, bad-tempered, and entirely fruitless. And when I got to the seminar at Chequers, it was very tempting to argue that dialogue with this creature and the regime he represented was entirely useless and pointless. Happily, one took the opposite view. It seemed to me that Gromyko's brutally unpromising performance powerfully reinforced my instinct that we needed desperately to look for fresh ways of getting through to the Soviet leadership. And gradually in our discussion, that view became crystallized between all of us at that meeting. And it was agreed that once the KAL crisis had died down, we should seek ways of improving the links in communication with the Soviet leadership. Margaret Thatcher characteristically attached conditions to that. And they illustrated the balance of the discussion. This search should go on, so long, she said, as she was not herself involved in it. And secondly, that she would retain a right to intervene to veto the process if it seemed the talks were, quote, going too far. So it was a fairly cautious signal to go ahead. But it did give us the essential go-ahead we wanted. And we realized, of course, it was going to take time. So the politics of where we intended to go were clear at that time. We did touch on a number of other problems, mainly those left over by imperial history. I won't go into those now, because each of them might take some time, ranging from the Falklands to Cyprus and Gibraltar. I'll carry on with the main story for the moment. We lost no time, in fact, in presenting our fresh approach to the United States. Just two or three weeks later, Margaret Thatcher was addressing the Winston Churchill Foundation in Washington, and she gave them the clear message, I quote, "We live on the same planet. We must be ready, therefore, and we are, if and when the Soviet leadership is ready, to commence talks with the Soviet leadership." And less than 2 weeks later, and this is something which people I don't think realized, we were both together on the platform of the Conservative Party conference. As it happened, I was presiding over the proceedings. Margaret Thatcher was speaking about general matters, but talking about our attitude towards arms control. And I saw her with her script well marked in front of her, breaking away from the script at one important point when she talked about arms control, and looking at the audience without the script, she said, "As I'm sure you will understand, there is no one more anxious for genuine disarmament than the person who bears the ultimate responsibility for the nuclear deterrent in our own country." And it was a very moving moment, that, to find her ad-libbing to that personal extent, committing her sincerity to the pursuit of a way through on that important subject. And we did indeed set about presenting the case, and she did in fact have her first visit behind the Iron Curtain to Hungary within 6 months, and that whetted her appetite for more. My own first visit to Moscow, the first visit by a foreign secretary for 7 years, apart from going to funerals, took place in July of 1984, and once again I had 6 hours with Gromyko. I did try to raise with him then, as on other occasions, the question of human rights. And on that occasion, his response was quite simple: "You're lowering the tone of our conversation." And it remained like that, and that set the tone of the entire encounter. But off stage, alongside our political endeavors, our professionals were also hard at work trying to see where we went next. And the Soviet Department of the Foreign Office, in concert with the intelligence services, picking up, for example, messages from our Tokyo post about conversations there between Prime Minister Trudeau and Mr. Arbatov of the Soviet Union, getting tips of that kind, getting useful tips from Mr. Oleg Gordievsky, second in command of the KGB post in the London Embassy, who was happily working on our side. And we were trying to identify the man most likely to succeed the hapless Konstantin Chernenko, the fragile, short-lived successor to Andropov. In fact, when I went to Moscow to see Gromyko, I'd taken with me some more important documents than my briefs about handling Gromyko. So I took with me an invitation from the chairman of our House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee, Sir Anthony Kershaw, to his opposite number in the Soviet Union, chairman of the Soviet Foreign Affairs Committee, youngest member of the Politburo, 52 years old, remarkably, Mikhail Gorbachev. It was the man whom we had fingered as the one most worthwhile influencing as far as the future was concerned. And the acceptance of that invitation was due, I think, to two factors. One, because it contained a well-directed political message from Margaret Thatcher, who was already identified as an important player in this scene. And two, because it was based upon a well-crafted diplomatic analysis. They designed an invitation it would be very hard to refuse. So the politics were right, and the professionalism was right. The third component had yet to become evident. That was the interpersonal chemistry between the two personalities involved. Mikhail Gorbachev arrived at Chequers on December the 16th of 1984 for lunch and for the afternoon discussions. And I spent 4 hours with Mikhail Gorbachev and Margaret Thatcher and the interpreters. And it was an extraordinary experience, because the communication between the two of them was so effective and so direct and so instant that the interpreters became, as they can sometimes do, virtually invisible, and was engaged in seeing the real communication between people. Mikhail Gorbachev had a spontaneity, an engaging style, quoting from his own notes in his own little manuscript book, quoting Palmerston at us in the usual way, and immediately one realized one was dealing with a Soviet citizen of a kind we'd never seen before. And Margaret Thatcher, unsurprisingly, was fluent, but measured, thoughtful, and manifestly sincere. And again, she came to the same central message. If Palmerston made the point that Britain has no permanent friends and no permanent enemies, but only permanent interests, then it echoed her message that we live on the same planet and we must find ways of living together on that same planet. And that was the message that Gorbachev had brought with him as well. The personalities of their relationship were crucial to the outcome. And by the end of that afternoon, Margaret Thatcher made the classic statement, he is, quote, a man with whom I can do business. Note the I. There were, in fact, only two or perhaps three people to whom Margaret had an immensely deferential attitude. One of them, perhaps surprisingly, was King Hussein, the most courteous man I ever encountered. And Margaret, in the presence of King Hussein, was bowing to him and Your Majesty this and Your Excellency that. That was one, but the other two she deferred to were Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. And I think that that set of personal relationships, her success in commending the two of them to each other, was probably her most important achievement in the whole field of foreign affairs in her life. Not, of course, that that was the only factor. People like tend to overlook the importance of Edward Shevardnadze. Edward Shevardnadze emerged from nowhere, as far as we are concerned, to replace Andrei Gromyko for the Helsinki Final Act 10th anniversary in July 1985, and he appeared at Helsinki. And I was able quite soon to learn a bit more about him, in a strange way, from the Mozambican foreign minister, Chissano, as he then was, when he met me at the airport in Maputo, and we talked, as one does on those sort of rather formal occasions, about our experience, and he had just come back from Moscow. And he described his time in Moscow with Shevardnadze. At the end of their talks, Shevardnadze said, well, we're due to go to the Bolshoi for the evening now, but maybe you don't want to, because I'd quite like to talk to you. And Chissano said, well, I'd like that too. And they spent the entire evening together, with Shevardnadze asking questions which Gromyko would never have asked, asking Chissano what he thought was wrong about the Soviet Union's policies towards Africa. And this was, again, an insight that is quite remarkable. And very shortly after that, Shevardnadze was making speeches to his own diplomatic corps. I quote just one sentence from one of them. The image of a state is in its attitude towards its own citizens, recognition of the sovereignty of the individual. And that wasn't just being made for public consumption, it was made to his own diplomatic people. The other factor that one must never overlook was the collective solidarity and wisdom of the NATO European Union organizations at that time. Schulz made a remarkable leader of the 16 foreign ministers of NATO. But there were people like Hans-Dietrich Genscher, for example, from Germany, of great experience. And all this made a great contribution to the strength which we brought together to the debate with the Soviet Union. That's enough of that for the moment, because I turn now to a less grand stage, where the same ingredients matter. The three ingredients I've talked about: getting the politics right, having the professionalism supporting those politics right, and having the right personality mix. And that happened, to our great good fortune, in the Anglo-Irish relationship. There was also a bit of luck about that, because we happened, as you may remember, to have recently become members of the European Community together. And until then, British ministers and Irish ministers didn't even say hello to each other. But once we joined the European Community, we began sitting alongside each other, discussing common interests there. Once we got into the habit of visiting each other in each other's countries, we went quite early, in 1980, I think, four ministers from the UK government to Dublin. Prime Minister Thatcher, Foreign Secretary Carrington, myself as Chancellor, and Humphrey Atkins, the Northern Ireland Secretary. And we had a meeting in Dublin Castle. And we realized that this was the first time British cabinet ministers had been in the Irish Free State or the Irish Republic since it had been invented. And one episode I remember quite clearly from that. I was put to sit next to an Irish Treasury official. And during the course of lunch, this chap, I forget his name now, turned to me and said, how would you like the claret then, Sir Geoffrey? I said, I'd like it very much indeed, it's very good. So you should, he said, at £84 a bottle. And I realized that Treasury officials were the same the world over, where price was the only thing that mattered. But the fact is, it was that chance coming together, and the fact that by chance the Irish electorate were in a rather oscillatory mood at that time, and put Garrett Fitzgerald into office, took him out again, put him back in again several times, for giving him just enough opportunities to make bright suggestions to Margaret Thatcher as to what should happen next. He met her in 1981, and he suggested then the establishment of an Anglo-Irish intergovernmental council, never heard of before, and it was a crucial component in everything that happened next, because that consisted of the two governments' cabinet secretaries. On our own side, Robert Armstrong, one of the most experienced and well-judged cabinet secretaries that I can remember, and a deputy secretary from the Foreign Office who was in the cabinet office, David Goodall, who was himself a very industrious member of an old Anglo-Irish family, very reflective. And we therefore had in place this group of senior officials on both sides for all the years that lay ahead before we took the whole process forward. Comparable opposite numbers, a very committed, very professional diplomatic structure in continuous existence through rough and smooth. And then again we had this extraordinary combination of personalities. Garrett Fitzgerald, one of the most irrepressible and enthusiastic and engaging people with whom I've had to deal, met Margaret Thatcher again when he was back in office at the European Stuttgart Summit in the summer of 1983. And he said, "Margaret, isn't it time we began having some substantive talks about all this?" And he describes Margaret's reaction as being immediately receptive. And both prime ministers became intensely engaged in this relationship for quite different reasons. Garrett Fitzgerald's concern was to get something being done to engage in the affairs of Northern Ireland, the minority community who were completely alienated from the government structure there. Every time he said to Margaret, "They're alienated," she said, "Stop using that awful word, Garrett. It's a Marxist word and I don't like to hear you using it." But it was his case and he was going to make it. Margaret's interest was quite different. She was determined not to betray the unionist community and above all, understandably, to enhance their security. And it was a fascinating episodic relationship with Garrett Fitzgerald, always the driving force carrying it forward, but Margaret Thatcher deserving real credit for her readiness to rise to that historic challenge. The politics of it were constant discussion, in a way that I think hardly takes place today, of the arrangements at cabinet level within our government, being considered not just by the generality of cabinet, but by people like William Whitelaw, who'd had experience as Northern Ireland Secretary, Quintin Hailsham, whose family had a long connection with the Ulster province, continuity of officials alongside that in interest by politicians. And I like to think a little continuity in the relationship from the existence of a Welsh Foreign Secretary, because during that time, Margaret Thatcher was at number 10, I was in the Foreign Office, there were no less than three different Northern Ireland secretaries. Jim Prior, first of all, Tom King, Douglas Hurd and Tom King. And every new one who arrived secured a re-injection from the Northern Ireland office in Belfast of unionist scepticism of the process. And they had to overcome that, understandably. And there was at least the continuo of a Welshman who had some insight into the importance of other people's patriotism. One of the things that Margaret didn't find it easy to understand was the concept that other people like herself could be patriotic in their own way. I've always been able to do that, I think, as a Welshman, because when I go to my native land in Wales, if I'm there for any length of time, I get fed up with the parochialism of some of the people I'm dealing with. But as soon as I get off the train at Paddington and I'm back in London, I begin to rile at the patronising attitudes of the bloody English. And I felt I could convey something of that to Margaret as to the way in which the Irish thought about us. So we did arrive at the Anglo-Irish Agreement in 1985. And that was another example of the triumph of her head over her heart. The fact that Margaret was prepared to be persuaded to achieve that. With some reluctance, and in some of her later writings, she actually said that the outcome had been disappointing. It was time, she said, to consider an alternative approach. But it was her commitment and the combination of her personality which carried the day with the unionist community as far as it did, and yet her mind took her there as it ought to have done. I think I'll cut the next... How are we doing for time? Yes, I better count the next bit. I'll come. If you want to talk about the Middle East, I'll come back to that later on. I'm going to come to another component of this historic legacy. Another of the obstacles constructed for foreign secretaries by their predecessors. Hong Kong, where better to address that problem? That was a problem whose priority had long been foreseen. A 99-year lease expiring on the 30th of June 1997. And one where we had a singularly weak hand. We claimed title to the freehold of 8% of Hong Kong as a result of a treaty we imposed upon the Chinese in the mid-19th century. But we claimed only a leasehold to 92% of it. And even then, only on the basis of a treaty which they challenged as unequal and invalid. We had one valid and important card, namely the unique, hugely prosperous condition of Hong Kong. If China wished to recover that, she wished also to recover it in working order, and was understandably reluctant to risk destroying it. But it was a set of negotiations where the head again had to overrule the heart if you were to get the right outcome. We got the right diplomatic resources in place, a long sequence of British officials as governors of Hong Kong, from Murray McElhose to Sir Edward Hughes and Lord Wilson, ambassadors, notably perhaps most of all Sir Percy Craddock, many people who had a real insight into Chinese conditions. And the Hong Kong Department in the Foreign Office, which during the 2 years of our negotiations expanded from a strength of 3 people to 23 people. During the 2 years, they received 4,000 telegrams from Beijing and Hong Kong about the progress of the negotiations and dispatched 2,400 telegrams back. So the professionalism was firmly in place. So too was the politics. We all had no doubt, Margaret Thatcher and I and the rest of our colleagues, on the need to find an outcome for the future of Hong Kong that would preserve all that was good about it. And we had a very effective, constant triangular consultation. We were working to a cabinet committee, meeting quite regularly in Downing Street at this end. We were in close consultation with the Executive Council in Hong Kong through the governor. The Hong Kong Exco came to London probably at least a couple of times a year, and I was going to Hong Kong with the same kind of frequency. And we were holding debates in Parliament and press conferences in Hong Kong. But the personalities here were quite different, because more than in any other relationship, Britain had contrived to produce what worked as a hard cop, soft cop relationship. Margaret Thatcher had met Deng Xiaoping only once in Beijing in September 1982, just 2 or 3 months after the St. Paul's service of thanksgiving for the reacquisition of the Falkland Islands. And the topic that was at the top of her mind was sovereignty and our entitlement to the sovereignty of Hong Kong. And a rather robust exchange took place between Margaret Thatcher and Deng Xiaoping, which resulted in some rather unhelpful conclusions. Deng Xiaoping set a 2-year limit for the conclusion of the negotiations. This must be finished, he said, by September 1984. And Margaret Thatcher, in the plane on the way back to Hong Kong from Beijing in an interview, said that she cast grave doubt on the Chinese willingness to respect any treaty, those that existed and anyone they might make in the future. So that relations were not terribly strong at that time. And it left the Chinese in no doubt that I, as Foreign Secretary, talking for a moment as I was an advocate, was having to handle a rather difficult client. By contrast, and only by contrast, they must have found me a fairly approachable advocate. But as the end of the 2 years approached, and we were trying to grapple for the key components of this elaborate document we finally achieved, we were converting Deng Xiaoping's 4 words, one country, two systems, which he elaborated into about 10 sentences. We turned that into a 14, 15, 16 page document, which was the Joint Declaration of the Future of Hong Kong. We had to fight for every inch of it. And remarkably, the Chinese deadline, the 2-year deadline, was working at the end of it in our interest. And within the last few days of those negotiations, we slipped in 2 very important bids for what we wanted in the concluding document. And they were both conceded. The Legislative Council shall be constituted by elections, and the executive shall be accountable to the legislature. And we got those in within a few days of the deadline, because the Chinese negotiators were being impressed by my difficulty in getting the case sold to my client, the Prime Minister. So that is another example. Again, I'll come back, if I may, to the sequel to that, because there's much to be said about what happened afterwards. I'm going to come now towards the conclusion of this political marriage. I haven't said much about what took it the wrong way. For a long time, the three P's I've talked about, politics, professionalism, personalities, remained in comfortable relationship with each other. But in the end, two topics working almost in tandem illustrated the decline in our working relationship. First was our transatlantic relations, and second, of course, was Europe. Relations with the United States changed in their nature during our time working together. They were tested by various episodes. First of all, quite early, Grenada, the decision by the United States to send troops into the tiny state of Grenada, without, in fact, any effective consultation with us. They decided to do so at a meeting in Atlanta, Georgia, on a Saturday morning. They assured us throughout the weekend, through all our inquiries in Washington, that they had no such plans. We had a meeting of ministers at 10:30 on the Monday morning and agreed that that was a sensible position. It wouldn't make sense to send troops into the island. And I so told the House of Commons at 3:30 that afternoon. At 5 o'clock that afternoon, we got a telegram from the White House saying that the Americans were planning to send their troops in within 12 hours. Could we offer them our advice? Margaret Thatcher and I then, as it happened, went out to separate dinners. I went to dine with the American Bankers Association in the presence of the American minister in the embassy. Margaret went to dine with somebody in the royal household in the presence of the American ambassador, neither of whom knew anything about what was afoot. By the time we got back to number 10 Downing Street at 11 o'clock, a second telegram had arrived saying that the troops were indeed going in at first light the following morning. And Margaret Thatcher thereupon telephoned Ronald Reagan, and he had to hold the telephone some distance from his ear, so we're told. But the die had been cast. And the interesting thing, if you read George Shultz's memoirs about it, it was a quite deliberate decision because of his fear that if Margaret Thatcher had got at Ronald Reagan before the thing had happened, she would have dissuaded him from doing it. But it was a very disturbing experience. And our reaction, Margaret Thatcher and my own at that time, was one of great dismay and indeed great anger, that we had to try and present the relationship with the United States in its usual comfortable fashion, at the same time to display our anger at what had happened. And David Steele, I think, commented that the Foreign Secretary, that's myself, had managed to achieve a unique feat by coming down on both sides of the fence at the same time. The other chap who did the same thing later on at a Commonwealth conference discussing it was Lee Kuan Yew. So when we discussed this episode at the Commonwealth Conference, you may imagine there were very different opinions. Mr. Nereri had much to be said in favor of the American attitude, because it was in line with what he had done with his intervention in Uganda to remove Obote from that country. Mr. Mugabe, on the other hand, had no sympathy with it, because it was in line with what he feared the South Africans might do to him. And Lee Kuan Yew arrived, as always, to crown the proceedings by saying that the Americans shouldn't have done it, but he was very glad they did. But that was the first episode in which Margaret Thatcher's reaction and mine was very much along the same lines. Again, when the Americans proposed to retaliate for the bombing of their nightclub in Berlin by bombing Libya, we had to react to that at quite short notice. And our reaction throughout that was again along the same lines. We were still working closely together. Because the Americans, as sometimes happens, said, we've got to have a response to this. And the word response features quite often in American political vocabulary. It's, I think, Greek for retaliation. And at all events, it doesn't have a very strong place in diplomatic affairs. And we worked for a long time, for 3 or 4 days anyway, to persuade them that we did believe there was a legitimate case for action against the Libyan regime, because we had no doubt about their responsibility for the bombing. But that case had to be founded on self-defense, that we could justify the use of American air bases in the UK for bombing of Gaddafi and his headquarters, in order to deter them from doing the same thing in the future. And we got the Americans to formulate the case in that way, to limit the nature of the attack they were going to make, to avoid too much collateral damage. And I was much criticized in the House of Commons and by most of the press, including some still represented in this room, for what we had done. It couldn't be justified. But as the months passed, people began to say, well, it seems to have worked. It becomes more and more difficult to criticize actions taken in self-defense when they appear to be defending you. And one of your earlier speakers in this series was an innocent victim, if you may like, of that process. Because at that time, one of those who criticized our conduct most vigorously was none other than David Owen. When the time came for us both to take part in a television broadcast 3 days after 9/11, and we were discussing on that broadcast whether the United States was entitled to take any action in response to 9/11, before I had begun to speak, David Owen began saying, well, of course they're entitled to take action in self-defense, as you remember they were at the time of Libya. And I said, but hang on, that's not what you said in 1985. And he acknowledged there and in the House of Lords later that day that he had been persuaded, so persuaded of the strength of our case, that he thought he'd believed in it himself. So that was another example of our minds working together on that. I think where we began to move apart, strangely, was in relation to the SDI, Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative, which became a very hot issue again in the early part of 1985. And I think the division between Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary was probably due, as much as anything else, to the fact that I am, and have been for 20 years of my life, a practicing lawyer. But Margaret Thatcher was, although a qualified lawyer, also a scientist. And I think her scientific reaction was attracted by the subtlety, the complexity, the potential of the Strategic Defense Initiative. And I was much more cautious. I was unwise enough in the speech made at that time to rather dismiss the concept as being like the creation of a Maginot line in space, a phrase that stirred Mr. Richard Pearl to intense wrath against me and didn't altogether endear me to the American administration. Margaret Thatcher, on the other hand, was actually addressing both houses of Congress not long afterwards. And in her memoirs, she has this to say, I used my speech to give strong support for SDI. I had a terrific reception. And she did indeed. I was there to witness the standing ovation which she received from Congress at that time. And I have to say, and this is relevant perhaps to today, that nothing is more calculated, in my view, to impair the judgment of a British Prime Minister than a standing ovation from both houses of Congress. Europe, again, has rather similar sequence of stories. It's easy to forget that for a number of years, our partnership successfully managed some quite difficult questions. The bloody British budget question, as Roy Jenkins called it, we were able to solve at Fontainebleau on a very satisfactory basis, where again Margaret displayed her characteristic self-confidence. We were offered a deal by President Mitterrand, finally, that we would be entitled to a refund of 65% of our contribution. We've been campaigning from the outset for 66%. Myself, as a fairly experienced trial lawyer, was prepared to think that 65 and 66% were pretty well interchangeable. Margaret Thatcher said, no, we must get our 66%. We went back to the council chamber, and the debate took place, and we got our 66%, which was worth £150 million over the next 10 years. So who was right? We also, together, succeeded in negotiating the Single European Act of 1985-1986, which effectively laid the foundations for the effective completion of the single market. It involved certainly an extension of qualified majority voting. It also laid the foundations for the common foreign and security policy, which we still struggle to achieve. Now, you may wonder why my party now denounces the very idea of a common foreign and security policy, when the agreement we made in 1985 was actually founded upon the text of a draft treaty on that subject, handed by Margaret Thatcher personally to Helmut Kohl at Chequers a few months before. So the idea has a long legitimacy. The sadness is we haven't achieved it. So that for a long time, in our European relationship with each other, as well as in our transatlantic one, we were quite clear on our political objectives, our personal relations were still compatible, and the professionalism was equally well established. I'm getting near the end now. I want to read you one other passage. The pattern of those early years was described by Margaret in the Downing Street Years, the first written volume of her memoirs, as follows. Quote, "As usual before European councils, I held a number of preparatory meetings with ministers and officials to ensure that I was properly briefed and to sort out with colleagues our precise objectives on each issue." That's true. That's what happened for a number of years. In her own book, she's describing what she did before the Athens summit of December 1983. But it continued like that for a number of years thereafter. But by the time we come to 1988 and the Madrid summit, which preceded Nigel Lawson's resignation and later my own, that pattern of political partnership was falling apart. Policy was being clarified not by discussion between ministers, but by officials bargaining and haggling over competitive speech drafts. And the relationship between us had become that distant. And that's no way of achieving political coherence and unity. And when, before the Madrid summit in June 1989, Nigel Lawson, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and I suggested that we ought to have a meeting with the Prime Minister to discuss our handling of that, we were denounced for having, quote, organized a cabal and, quote, mounted an ambush. That is the sadness of that deteriorating relationship. I wonder, could anything have been done to prevent that deterioration? There were several factors that, in retrospect, might have made a difference. One, which is an interesting one, is that a man who'd held the ship together for a long time in Downing Street was the present Lord Williamson, who was the Cabinet Deputy Secretary with responsibility for coordination of our European policy. He was an ideal candidate to become the first non-French Secretary of the European Commission. And we decided that we would like to get that job for a Briton, and that David Williamson was the right man for it. So we put him in for that, and he succeeded Emile Noel, the first and only holder of that important office. But did we, in winning that position in Brussels, lose the key man who could have held us together in London on our European partnership? I don't know. One other tragic event, which preceded not by very long my departure from government, was the murder by the IRA of my closest political friend and one of Margaret Thatcher's closest political friends, who had been her first remarkably successful parliamentary private secretary, Ian Gow. He was murdered by a bomb in his own car outside his own home. He was the closest political friend of both Margaret and myself. And if anyone had provided the glue in our relationship when the going was rough, it was Ian. So what are the crucial determinants of governmental success? Above all, the common will of senior ministers to reach policy agreement clearly and plainly and effectively. That is the fundamental necessity. That may be made easier, may be made possible in some cases, by the existence of a well-lubricated professional machine. But they cannot bridge an unbridgeable gap, and the process may be rendered impossible by the lack of the personal relationship that is necessary. Au fond, it is that personal political relationship that makes the government tick and work, above all between the Prime Minister and her two senior colleagues in the Foreign Office and the Treasury. Without that, then the regime is heading into difficulties. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you will agree that was an enthralling political analysis. Just think what it would be like if we could, as researchers, go back and interview Palmerston or Salisbury or whoever, Halifax or whoever. It would be an unparalleled opportunity. Most historians have to make do with a written record. But this is, as has often been said, living history, having the opportunity to hear a very senior participant give a most thoughtful and of course extremely well-informed analysis. That said, of course, people are in this situation always looking back, and memory may play tricks, and politics plays tricks as well. So there are many different versions of history, but we've heard a very compelling one here tonight. Now we've got a little time for questions. Lord Howe has very kindly agreed to take some for about 20 minutes, so I'll try to be fair to all sides of the hall. This gentleman here in the front, please keep your remarks brief and wait for the mic to arrive.
Could you perhaps comment briefly about the Middle East and about the sequel to Hong Kong?
What a shrewd fellow you are. Because those are the two passages I had designed to skip if necessary, and which I did skip. First of all, as far as the Middle East is concerned, I think it is the most serious problem by miles that the world faces currently, or most pressingly, and the most intractable. And I remember discussing it at a gathering about 18 months ago, attended by George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, and Lee Hamilton. And I thought it was relevant to remind them of our own Irish experience, because our Irish problem springs from the fact that 300-400 years ago, a group of white English-speaking Christians were implanted amongst a lot of other white English-speaking Christians. And it hasn't been very happy since then. In 1920, if you read Roy Jenkins' biography of Winston Churchill, you'll find there a description of what was happening at that time, in which the Black and Tans, the military force that had been organized, were seeking to impose martial law in all but name throughout Ireland. And we were about to impose martial law, and about to find the city of Cork half burnt to the ground by British troops. And Lloyd George made a speech at the Guildhall banquet in which he said, I quote, "We have murder by the throat." He thought he was winning. Yet within 2 years, he had to acknowledge the creation of the Irish Free State. And 80 years thereafter, we're struggling to come to terms with that. When we were in the middle of the Anglo-Irish Agreement negotiations, I remember drawing a little sketch plan, doodling at the table in Downing Street, showing Great Britain on the map, and then Ulster with six lines between Great Britain and Ulster, one line between Ulster and the Republic, and one between the Republic and Great Britain. And then drawing the same map alongside it, with three lines in each place, a balanced relationship. Under the first I put 1984, under the second I put 2084. Now that is the time expectation that I thought not unreasonable as we were grappling with it in those early days. And I commended this example to those who were looking at the problem in the Middle East. And when I've mentioned that to some much older, much more experienced Zionists, they say, you're absolutely right, and that is the picture of the future that the original Zionist leaders had, a recognition of the need to recognize the rights of those people who were already living there, of the need to come together rather than stand apart. So I think the process is hideously more difficult than it looks, and that's saying something. It will take much, much longer than anyone has thought about. And it will require the presence of help from the outside world for a very, very long time indeed, and pressure on both sides of a genuinely balanced kind. If you think of the other bases, Britain has had, for example, apart from our engagement in Ireland, we've had troops on the line in Cyprus for decades, trying to maintain that position. So I fear it is the most intractable problem. I'm dismayed by the extent to which efforts like those being made by the Quartet are marginalised and not sustained. And I think that it is one of the areas where Europe passionately needs a common foreign security policy. We had a good shot at it, and Peter Carrington shaped the Venice Declaration in 1979. A very hopeful thing is happening now with three foreign ministers in Iran making an input on that basis. But it needs the most massive mobilisation of that kind of effort. And above all, it needs a sustained commitment to the United States of a kind that is going to be very, very difficult for us to maintain because of the links between the State of Israel and the United States. Now that's one problem, but just your other one quickly. Hong Kong. I think that the relationship went wrong, I'm very sad to say this, during the time when Chris Patten was governor of Hong Kong. He's someone for whom I have the most immense admiration as a politician in every role. Of course, he wanted, and who didn't, to see a further advance in the democratization structure of the Hong Kong Constitution. But sadly and astonishingly, but I'm sure this is right, before he went there as governor, and after Rights East being foreign secretary, Douglas Hurd, in negotiation with Chen Qichun and his opposite number, the Chinese foreign minister, had negotiated in secret negotiations the timetable and the pattern for the progressive democratization of Hong Kong. And they were covered in 7 letters, all of them off the record, in the way in which we did a lot of negotiation secretly when we were negotiating the original deal. And Chris Patten had never seen that correspondence. It is quite astonishing, but he was not briefed about that, and he launched his campaign for more democratization in a speech as Governor General, his first speech as Governor General, which sent the Chinese wild with fury, because it was a breach of the convention governing the way in which relations were conducted. And he never recovered in his relationship from that mistake, for which he wasn't responsible, in truth. The Chinese went on calling him by bad names that they threatened to do, and they did in fact repeal the changes he'd made. And the through train, the concept that we'd had of progressive change with Chinese acceptance, pressing them all the time to take it further, was wrecked by that. Now, it was a great tragedy, because had it been more continuously done, I visualized the handover as being a much more friendly, celebratory, mutually celebratory occasion. After we negotiated the Hong Kong Joint Declaration, I went there with Her Majesty the Queen on a state visit in 1986. And that was a deeply moving occasion to be there, as it were, welcomed at the Royal Court of Beijing with barbarian monarchs from Europe, and traveling through the scarcely illuminated streets of Shanghai with millions of Chinese looking at Her Majesty. In Guangdong and Shanghai, the Royal Yacht was there on parade. With a tremendous festival atmosphere. We entertained the entire Chinese government by the Queen on the Royal Yacht in Shanghai. And I visualized the hand back when it took place as being redolent of the de Klerk-Mandela mutual handclasp, a genuine commitment to partnership. And I visualized the Royal Yacht as being there as part of the celebrations in 1997. In fact, it was there, but it was so used that looked like Dunkirk, with Chris Patten and the Prince of Wales clambering aboard and making their getaway, so to speak. It was exactly the antithesis of what I wanted, and it was unnecessary through some extraordinary misunderstanding. The man who masterminded the negotiations was Sir Percy Craddock, an immensely skillful diplomat who guided us through all of that. The man who showed the Chinese how to govern a would-be democratic society was Chris Patten. His public performance in Hong Kong, showing how democratic leadership should be conducted, is very like what Hu Jintao is now doing in China. Much greater communication between Hu Jintao and his Prime Minister, Wen Jiabao, following the Patten model. What I wanted to see was a combination of Craddock's guile and Patten's style. We'd have got the best of both worlds. But it isn't doing badly at all. Hong Kong is going through the remainder of the economic storm, still facing those difficulties. But if you think about it, the creation and maintenance of that miracle of capitalist dynamic in the heart of the world's largest communist country, and that country itself now burgeoning with new activity, it's a very, very exciting process. So I'm pleased about it.
Can you hear at the back, by the way? Perhaps we put the mic a little bit easier? I'm going to try and take questions from round the floor now. There's a gentleman in the front here.
Do you believe the collapse of the Soviet Union inevitable? And what are your thoughts about the future relations with Russia? Thank you.
Question, do I believe the collapse of the Soviet Union is inevitable? And what about our future relations with Russia? I think it's an impossible question to answer that. Well, all I know is that in 1989, I remember making 2 speeches in the early part of 1989 calling for the Berlin Wall to be destroyed and the Iron Curtain to be removed, and being denounced by The Guardian, no less, for launching such frivolous, unrealistic, unattainable ideas. I remember The Economist in that same year, in September 1989, saying that such fanciful things should be dismissed from people's consideration. So nobody then began to realize just how fragile it was. And I don't to this day know how far the Soviet leadership had any impression of that. I find it very hard to believe that Mikhail Gorbachev and even Edward Shevardnadze expected that they were precipitating the disintegration of...
whom you're a personal friend, no?
Yes, indeed, yes. Precipitating that disintegration. And Mikhail Gorbachev constantly said he wanted to see communism reformed and not destroyed. So I don't think we could have been expected to see that, but we hoped to see, you know, a liberalization and an outwardness, which we did get. I think that it's sad now to contrast the still very poorly condition of Russia with the dynamic of China, because Russia has got a hugely well-educated, talented population, a great deal of raw materials, and it is taking a long and painful time for it to emerge successfully from that. I confess, worried by the apparent decline in the openness of the Russian system of government now, the tendency to corral newspapers in a way that was not happening in the Yeltsin era, and the continuing commitment to the Chechnya conflict and the way that it's there. And I think that the corruption problems are also very serious. I think we need to give Russia all the encouragement and help we can. That sounds very patronizing. Russia can only save herself in the end, and there's not much we can do about it. But we don't certainly want to go back into hostility or stigmatizing her. She needs all the help we can give her.
Fortunate in having the Guardian present in the room in the person of Miss Hella Pick, who I think would like the right of reply. I've seen your...
No, absolutely no. I'm not looking for a right of reply. No, I wanted to ask you, you described the marriage that ended in divorce. You've only hinted at the degree of partnership there was, and I just wondered if you'd like to comment how equal or unequal you saw this partnership in terms of foreign policy initiatives. Which leads me to the next sort of allied question. Do you think that power for foreign policy making, including much of the apparatus that supports the Prime Minister, has shifted to number 10, and that the Foreign Office, in a way, has just become an to the main foreign policy establishment at number 10?
Well, that's a topic I gather David Owen talked about a couple of weeks ago. Oh, no. But I think that the answer to your question is the power has shifted to some extent. But there has always been this struggle between number 10 and the Foreign Office, not just in this country, but in others as well, I think. If you look at Macmillan's book called, it's called something like Great Leaders. He wrote a book about previous prime ministers. And he describes there the relationship between Chamberlain and Eden at the time of the discussions with Mussolini. And there's a passage in Chamberlain's diaries about that in which Chamberlain says, I wrote a letter to Signor Mussolini proposing this, that, or the other, I forget what, and I received a very cordial reply from him. I had not shown this letter to the Foreign Office before I wrote it, because I was afraid they might make me change my mind. So prime ministerial attempts to dominate the policy-making process is not entirely new. I think it's made much more likely by the huge speed of foreign policy formulation now and by the extent to which heads of government are involved in that process. If you think of the way in which, after any summit, you and your colleagues, your former colleagues, are waiting like badgers outside the hall, and questions are posed, shot at prime ministers, heads of government, so fast that policymaking can be very difficult to handle. And I think that it's one of the most important things that one should try and restore or maintain, which is a well-disciplined, professional management of foreign policy. That's one of my three Ps: politics right, professionalism right, and personalities right. I think that the tendency for heads of government to wander around the world alone, and sometimes to do so without any senior foreign policy advisors with them, is profoundly foolish.
So I suppose I'm saying yes to your question. I can take it even further. There's a book shortly to be published by Robert Cooper called The Failure of Nations. And you'll find that there's a quote from me commending that book on the cover, or on the leaflets anyway. And what that quote says is it's a remarkably lucid book, a comprehensive book, brilliantly written. This book should be compulsory reading for all foreign ministers and heads of government. What they've left off the quotation attributed to me is the last bit of it. For all foreign ministers and heads of government, preferably well before they enter office. I think the danger following from the arrival of a domestically trained head of government, the responsibility for foreign policy, and the risk of them disregarding the professionalism, is a very serious one.
Time is running on, and Lord Howe's got to go. I'm going to take two people who've been waiting patiently. I'm going to take those two questions together, if I may. First, you, sir, and then the question here.
Thank you, Professor Hill. The title is very sensational or very scandalous, because on behalf of the British government, the LSE has accepted that not problems are not just left over. Problems are left over all over the world, especially Commonwealth, hastily and greedily. In Kashmir, they are still bleeding. Mr. Howe, would you please compare and contrast the detainees in Guantanamo Bay and the captives in Iranian embassy? Of course, it's beyond your time period, but it's very crucial, because at that time there was regime change. Jimmy Carter lasted, you were shoulder to the so-called relationship.
No question, yeah, not a speech.
Yeah, compare about the detainees in Guantanamo Bay and the captives in Iranian embassy. At that, there were American here who were Afghans.
All right, well, that's one.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
On an entirely different subject, Lord Howe, I'd like to ask you about what you think prospects of the Conservative Party are the next election, and what it can do to improve
prospects. I think the prospects of the Conservative Party are slightly better than those of the detainees in Guantanamo Bay. But seriously, Guantanamo Bay, I didn't, I'm afraid, capture the parallel you were talking about, but I think that anyone who is concerned with a structure of international law must be concerned at the equivocal and extraordinary status with which the people in Guantanamo Bay are now being treated. And you'll see that the present government, the British government, is making strong representations. I think that it must be damaging to the cause and defence of democracy and the rule of law if those principles are set aside so fundamentally in the present course of war against terrorism. I think the concept of a war against terrorism is profoundly misleading. One has to fight a whole range of ways to protect one's citizens from terrorism and tackle the causes of terrorism. Those causes may sometimes be linked, and there are international relationships. I found when we were dealing with the IRA, there were exchanges of resources, of ammunition, of advice with other terrorist groups around the world. So they are linked, but it oversimplifies it to talk about war against terrorism. And the handling in a way that is compatible with the rule of law is very, very important. As far as the Conservative Party is concerned, I think I'm not in favour of a leadership contest, because I wrote in an article some time back that the Tory Party and Duncan Smith are stuck with each other. I don't think that a leadership contest at the present time, in the present way, would solve anything, because it would merely create further antagonism, I think. If the parliamentary party were to come together and say, we are all of one mind, we believe that the time has come for you to go and we've got X or Y or Z to replace you, then that might signal a change at that level. But beneath that, I think the most important thing is for whoever leads the Conservative Party, remarkably, to follow Margaret Thatcher's example when she was first appointed. When Margaret was elected, most people were astonished. They didn't expect her to be elected. John Campbell, in his book about his first volume of biography, says more or less, I think I've said it more clearly, that sex was her secret weapon. Not that she seduced the 1922 committee, but that so few people thought a woman could possibly win that nobody took any steps to stop her winning. And she did win. And what she did was to gather around her all the older statesmen, the Whitelaws, the Hailshams, the Carringtons, and broaden her base. Currently, the last two or three times, the Conservative leadership has been defending a narrower and narrower base. It's diminished its own magnetism. Somehow it's got to begin radiating the feeling that we've got to get together. And I think that the cause that I would commend to them is much more the cause that Oliver Letwin, if you like, has identified. The central problem of British politics
today. Speaking at this very moment elsewhere in the LSE.
Fine, I'm glad I'm getting as good an audience as I am. The central problem about democracy today is the disbelief of electors and the strident, combative tone and manner of all political discussion. I think that if politicians shout at each other as loudly and as irreverently and as foolishly as they do, they hardly claim to be entitled to an audience. And people long to see grown-up political debate with grown-up people. They also long to see politicians who can actually respond to what most of them feel. If you go into any staff room, any school, any hospital, any business now, and say, what would you like us to do next? The response you get almost certainly is, for heaven's sake, leave us alone. And if politicians are to be less restless, more prepared to be outward going and engaging people in debate, then I think that would be the best sort of description for the Tory party to follow. I can't resist incidentally the temptation to add two quite different thoughts. One, to this gathering of youthful dynamos, or mainly youthful dynamos, if you care about the society in which you live, for heaven's sake, don't dismiss the possibility of becoming involved in politics. It's only through the political systems you can change the society in which you live. So do be prepared to get engaged, but try and avoid getting engaged until you've succeeded manifestly and well in something else. I think that those two pieces of advice are enormously important, and because it gives you an independence, it gives you an experience, and my great dismay is the descent of our political process into being handled by almost entirely professional politicians organized in deeply tribalized political parties. But that's why I've resisted the arrival of elected members in the House of Lords, because the last thing we want to see in the House of Lords are clones of the clowns in the Commons.
Well, ladies, that's a pretty good note to end on. I'm actually going to take one more to bring it back to foreign policy with your permission. Lady in the front here. And then we're just a very quick one, and then we'll stop because...
I wanted to ask you about the European Constitution, what you think the significance is in the current wrangling.
Gosh, well, it's a bit late to start on that now. I think that... I don't think it's going to be a very satisfactory document. I mean, I'm being very arrogant about it. I think it's a hugely important document to try and make the system more manageable and more intelligible. I don't think it's being handled with sufficient high-powered, concentrated talent. I think that for all the people that have been engaged in it, it's emerging as a very muddled document. And in particular, our own government here hasn't treated it as seriously and as consistently and as continuously as I think it ought to have been treated. So I'm perplexed, I'm worried that it's actually creating more misunderstanding than understanding. I'm not going to go into the detail of it, because we'd be here all night.
Which we mustn't be. So, Lord Howe, I would like to thank you very much for what has been, in your own language, an extremely grown-up political analysis, highly sophisticated. We've all learned a lot from what you've said, and almost as much from reading between the lines, I think. So thank you. I'm most grateful to you for coming.
Thank you very much.